decided to focus on Dayton partly because I did a lot of reporting there during the campaign in 2016, so I had gotten to know the place pretty well. But beyond that, it really is a very representative of a whole swath of small and mid-sized cities across the Midwest. And it also has some kind of fascinating, sort of more particular details that I found very compelling. One is that it has this big new Chinese-owned auto glass plant that this huge Chinese company came in and bought the big GM plant that was abandoned by GM during the crash in 2008. And so now you have this big Chinese company that's come in and bought this big plant and is employing people there again at much lower wages than they used to get at GM. The city also has been hit as hard as any by the opioid epidemic, just astonishing numbers in the Dayton area. And then another quirk of the place that I found interesting is that it has become home to a remarkable community of Russian Turks. These are refugees who came over here in the last decade. About 12,000 of them came to the States in the mid-2000s, and a lot of them settled in Dayton, and they've become a very prosperous sort of subculture in Dayton, mostly around the trucking industry. And so I was drawn to the place partly for that as well. A whole bunch of reasons that made Dayton a very appealing place for us to come to.
And Dayton has quite a history, much like most of our Midwestern cities.
Exactly. That's another real draw of the place, is that it has this extraordinary history of industrial innovation, which, you know, I was not really aware just how rich that history was until I started spending time there. I knew about the Wright brothers, of course, but not about all these other just really amazing industrial inventors and innovators, guys like Charles Kettering, who just spun off just an endless list of major advances, including the electrical starting motor in the early 1900s. Dayton, right around the turn of the century, 1890, 1900, around there, was actually leading the country in per capita patents coming out of there. So really, to see a place that was really, it's not an exaggeration to say that it was Silicon Valley of its age, and now having fallen so far behind our new Silicon Valley, to me, that the film is overall, it's about Dayton, but underlying that is this problem we have now where you have these huge gaps opening up between what are now our new prosperous cities, our new hyper-prosperous cities, places like the Bay Area and Boston and D.C. and Seattle, New York, and other cities. And those gaps have just gotten way bigger than they used to be. We've always had richer and less rich cities, but the gaps now between the hyper-prosperous cities and others are just astonishingly large.
What has happened over time when you talk about those gaps? There was that period, I believe, during the 80s when a number of northern corporations headed south, you know, receiving tax breaks and other benefits. What happened in Dayton's case?
In Dayton's case, you know, it's definitely been a steady accumulation of different factors, starting really with white flight. And I think one thing you really can't overlook when you look at the history of these cities and their shrinkage is that it really started with white flight. Even before things started getting rough economically, you had this big rush out of the cities in response to the arrival of African Americans who were coming up in the Great Migration. And I think we often sort of think of urban flight as tied to economic decline. But in fact, it often preceded it. So that starts the decline, where people simply moving out of the suburbs and you start getting the blight and abandonment in the core. Then you do start having as you mentioned, the move of manufacturing to the south. Then NAFTA definitely has a role to play in the early 90s, speeding departure of a lot of auto part companies that were in Dayton down to Mexico. Dayton was the second largest GM town in the country after Detroit, and I think maybe even second largest auto industry town in general after Detroit. So it gets hit by NAFTA, and then it really gets hit by the admission of China into the WTO in 2000. There's been more and more very solid economic research coming out showing just what a huge impact that move, admitting China into the WTO, had on manufacturing areas, arguably even larger than the impact of NAFTA. And then finally, you have, of course, the Great Recession, which just clobbered places like Dayton. Now you have these cities with unemployment rates that look okay. They've basically gotten their levels of basic employment back to pre-recession levels, but the wages are just much lower, as exemplified by Fuyao, this Chinese company, paying workers less to work in the same building than GM used to pay.
Do you you think that's one reason why this company decided to begin manufacturing in Dayton?
Oh, absolutely. It was this really striking moment. We got an interview with the Chinese billionaire who owns this company, founded it, and he's a self-made, you know, has a sixth grade education, but very sort of blunt-speaking, forthright guy. We asked him about his low wages, relatively low wages that he's paying at the factory, and I asked him, do Americans need to accept that they're going to be making less money at manufacturing than they used to? He objected to the whole premise of the question. He said, basically, the comparison should not be with what you used to be making in Dayton. The comparison should be with Mexicans and Chinese and Japanese workers. And by that standard, he said, he's still paying workers here in Dayton more than they'd be making in Mexico. So what's the problem?
You mentioned a number of the trade deals and the fallout from those deals. This is another one of those examples. Are we seeing that globalization taking place where the playing field is level everywhere?
Very much so. I mean, that's what's been happening in Dayton. And what you see, the research on the effect of the mission of China into the WTO sort of gets across is that the impact has been so uneven across parts of the country that if you're in one of these cities that are thriving, that have basically moved seamlessly into the information age, you're only seeing the gains of trade. You're seeing cheaper goods for you to buy in the store, and then on top of that, the things that you make, the sort of information age goods that you make, whether it's entertainment or internet-related businesses, they recoup the gains tenfold of globalization. Then you're not seeing any of the costs that communities like Dayton are feeling very acutely. It's a very kind of localized hurt that comes from the new landscape.
This truly is, much like the title, Those Who Are Left Behind in America. If you're Dayton, it's those people who are left behind, and you see the poverty rate skyrocket, and then how does a community that is already struggling take care of those who are left behind?
Well, very much so. When you're there, it's just the need is just, that you see all around you. It's so palpable. One thing you notice in communities like Dayton now is that there's this massive safety net industry that's sprung up to care for people who are struggling. There's a huge homeless shelter in Dayton that is housed in the building that used to be the goods warehouse for one of the big department stores downtown that has since closed. You have endless soup kitchens and food pantries scattered around town, almost too many to keep track of. Those services, in turn, actually end up drawing people to the city. You have a lot of people coming to the city from outlying towns and suburbs who are in need or are addicted to drugs, and they come to Dayton because Dayton is where you can buy your drugs, and it's also where you can get drug treatment or other social services. So it's just almost kind of a magnet effect where the sort of winner-take-all cities that are now so hyper-prosperous and thriving are drawing highly educated people for high-paying jobs. You now have communities like Dayton that are drawing people of much different sort in for safety net services. It's this kind of inversion of that effect.
There's so much competition also throughout the Midwest as each city tries to figure out how to move forward. You've seen great strides in Pittsburgh. Cleveland is turning it around. Neighboring Cincinnati does very well. Detroit, right? The hub of automotive manufacturing, it's going through its revival. We're here in Grand Rapids where we're doing quite well. What is taking place in Dayton? I can't imagine that the white flag has been hoisted into the air, but I would imagine there's also a community saying, okay, let's figure this out. What do we do to move forward and be successful?
Yeah, they are. They're definitely still striving, and they have definitely had some signs of a real rebirth. They've got these beautiful old buildings downtown, a lot of old industrial buildings downtown that are now being converted into lofts, like you see in a lot of other industrial cities. You've got this really kind of incredible microbrewery scene. A lot of cities have their microbreweries, but I'd put Dayton up against any towns. You have a fair amount of economic development going on around Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the huge Air Force Base that's just outside Dayton. But in general, what I see in the Midwest is that I see a kind of a winner-take-all effect at the regional level, where you have certain cities that have become sort of the winner town in a whole area. And in Ohio, that really is Columbus. There was a great report that came out a year or two ago showing just how much Columbus is leaving the rest of the state behind by all sorts of different metrics of growth and development. often it's the city that is the home to the state university, to the state capital, that is really kind of leaving everyone else in the dust. And it becomes this kind of, again, kind of a winner-take-all effect where companies feel like if they're going to be in that region, they should be in that place. And you saw a little bit with the Amazon HQ2 search, where the cities in the Midwest that made the cut for HQ2 are really the ones that have become those kind of regional winner-take-all cities. It was Columbus, it was Nashville, it was Pittsburgh, it was not Detroit, it was not Cleveland, it was not Cincinnati, and it was certainly not Dayton. There's that effect going on, and it really, it's especially acute when you look at the next tier of cities. Cincinnati and Cleveland can certainly point to real gains that they're making. Where you're seeing real struggles is at the sort of next level of cities, the Akrons, Daytons, Toledos, and then even the smaller cities, Mansfields and Lancasters and Chillicothes, those sort of Zanesvilles, that's that sort of 50,000 to 80,000 population city is where you're seeing a lot of hurt still.
What is the takeaway for the viewers?
For me, it's just that I want people to be aware of what's happening in places like Dayton. I want people who, especially people who are living in these kind of hyper-prosperous bubbles, to just be aware of what's going on in these cities, what they're up against, what people there are struggling with, what they're dreaming for their cities, just to really be, I think we've gotten so clustered in our different bubbles now that simply being exposed to what things are actually like on the ground in a place like Dayton has some inherent value. And then on top of that, for people to be thinking about what we can do to try to balance things out a little bit, because I just don't think that these huge disparities we're seeing now between some places that are incredibly prosperous and incredibly expensive and other places that are really struggling and have, you know, thousands of vacant homes to spare, that's not a healthy situation to me for anyone. So for us to think about what we can do to really kind of just kind of, in the memorable phrase of, you know, Joe the Plumber, to sort of spread the wealth a little bit between regions would be what I hope people think about.
Frontline's Left Behind America, ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis. Thank you so much.
Well, sure. Thank you.